This is Brian Feldman, October 3rd, 1992. Developmental Approach to Analytical Psychology. Tape 3 of 3.
Treatments, but there were young people being mandated for criminal activity on 2 to 4 hours constantly.
A week.
Total.
Total, sorry.
So I would actually see people for 2 hours or 2 1-hour sessions, and that was.
So you're the miracle worker.
That is an astonishing kind of.
It's step 1, 2, 3, and 4.
I see. That's very. I don't know what. I can't comment on that really anymore. I don't know what to say. I think that there's some areas or some cultures that are more analytic, and others obviously that where the behavioral aspect is much more prominent. But. When I see even as autistic kids 2 or 3 times a week, it's not so much questioned about them needing intensive treatment. The only time I've had questions is when it might be a more transient type of disorder, you know, an adjustment reaction or something more sort of neurotic that might be seen less. But if the child or the adolescent is suicidal or is self-destructive like Ed or Diana, then they seem to support much more in the families. Of course, you know, both of these cases, obviously, they came from wealthy families, so they could support this type of treatment over a long period of time. So obviously that's another aspect of it, that they both wanted in some way. The father kept supporting her treatment, and the father kept supporting Ed's treatment when he was being seen. So I think that's a different value system, perhaps, that people would consider analysis very important for their kids if they're having severe difficulties. Now, the other thing, where I grew up in New York, it was also very accepted. So that culture was, a bit different, obviously, than California, but also it was quite accepted analysis. And perhaps here it hasn't grown yet to that extent, that it's something that's growing. They're not treating the whole person. Okay. I don't want to go too much over. We have to stop at 4 o'clock? 4:30. Oh, good. Okay. Let me see. Maybe I can. Okay, let me get into some of her, some of the issues in terms of the transference in this particular case. Again, I said that, you know, I felt that this experience of needing me to recreate the mother-daughter and the father-daughter experience were quite critical. And I needed to understand my own countertransference in order to really get a deeper understanding of her history. It was like she couldn't use words to tell me about her history. She needed to have her history enacted in the transference-countertransference relationship. So there was a reason, I think, that she needed to make me feel so impotent and so rejecting and uncaring and helpless. This was, I think, very, very critical. At times, Diana described feeling possessed like a witch. When binging, she experienced a frenzied state and felt like another person. It was like a dissociation. A bag lady, a criminal, or a demon, she reported. She occasionally came to her sessions in this frame of mind, and it did feel as if she were another person. She was secluded in her own thoughts, difficult to reach, and I often felt helpless and ineffective, as if my own capacity for thought and reflection had been attacked and destroyed. I described the impact that her emotional states had upon my thought processes, and she slowly began to realize the power of her destructive and rageful feelings. So I really needed to get to a place where I could share that with her and explain to her the impact that some of this had upon me, and it seemed quite important for her. She was attempting to make me understand through my own inner experience the potency of her rageful and destructive feelings and the devastating impact this had upon her own psychological functioning. Because of her difficulty in articulating her emotional experiences, she needed to have me experience through my countertransference responses the nature and intensity of her destructive aspects. At times, I felt possessed by her, filled with toxic emotions I needed to evacuate. And as I said, I often felt enormously hungry after our sessions. And at one point, my hands were trembling, and I felt filled with Diana's presence, a state of possession which I could only abate by actually leaving the consulting room and making space for reflection on my feelings. Alongside her destructive fury, there was a profound identity confusion. Diana was unsure about her ambitions and goals and had no idea what she wanted to major in at university. She went from a major in engineering to economics to sociology and then to human biology. She was not sure whether she wanted to stay at the university or go and study in Europe. Any major decision seemed enormously difficult for her. She could not commit herself to a life pattern or goal, and she had no idea at that time about what type of career would provide her with some meaning. She was fearful of intimacy, and while she was attractive and intelligent and often had young men interested in spending time with her, she was frightened of their sexuality and any sexual demands which might be placed upon her. At one point, she had sexual intercourse with a young man and quickly became anxious, fearful, and suspicious of him. Her anxiety about vaginal penetration and her fear of the penis, which she viewed as potentially destructive, were heightened by her sexual involvement, and she realized she had to discontinue the relationship. As we explored and reflected upon her sexuality, memories and feelings about her father began to emerge. She thought primarily of her father as a representation of her false self. When he called, he questioned her about what she was doing for fun. He wanted her to resolve her conflicts by being socially extroverted and not through introspection and analysis. Diana felt grossly misunderstood by her father. She accommodated by telling him things she felt he wanted to hear, but she rarely told him about her internal distress. At one point, he thought that she was having a socially active life because of all of the credit card charges he received from restaurants. He had given her a credit card so that she could be more involved socially. He did not realize that she was using the credit card for binging. She remembered her father being seductive and wanting to have an emotionally intimate relationship. Her Oedipal attachment to him was largely unresolved. He was viewed as sexually aggressive, lacking generational boundaries, impulsive, and unpredictable. Her desire for her father was mixed with confusion, anger, and resentment, as he had not provided her with the support, empathy, and trust she so desperately needed. In addition, the parental intercourse was viewed as aggressive, coercive, and potentially assaultive, and this largely contaminated her own views about heterosexual relationships, as any image of tender sexuality became contaminated with aggressivity. As these memories were reported, Diana began to experience rage and anger towards me in the transference. She became rageful because she yearned for an emotionally close relationship with me, yet feared that I, like her father, would have expectations and make emotional demands upon her. She thought that I too could be intrusive, penetrating, coercive, and assaultive, and that I would put pressure on her to change while not truly understanding the depth of her psychic pain. She had felt inadequately responded to by her father, and she feared that the analytic relationship with me could recapitulate her early failures and disappointments. At this time, Diana's eroticism was beginning to emerge in the transference, and I attempted to hold and contain these feelings and explore with her the nature of her desires. I began to experience a warmer, more tender feeling towards her, which helped me weather her rageful attacks. Her desire for closeness was infused with rage as she feared being emotionally penetrated and invaded by me. Only by creating a safe distance between herself and myself, and by substituting food and bulimia for a real relationship, could she feel more in control of her emotional neediness. And I think it was at this period that she was doing a lot of vomiting in the bathroom in the office, outside of the office. Sort of, she was feeling this strong need for closeness, yet whenever she approached it, it would create this sort of panic reaction in her. What's going to happen next? At this time, Diana felt analysis was an activity she did not want to have any feelings about, and her aloofness and indifference were the means she used to guard against deep affectional and dependency needs. During this period, she sometimes left my consulting room, as I said, went to the toilet and vomited, thus getting rid of the session in a concrete, pre-symbolic way. She was bringing the bulimia into the transference so that I would become the fed and vomited out upon breast. She was using the bulimia to control the analysis. Between these sessions, I felt anxious and concerned about her. a preoccupation which made me feel that something was happening at a deeper emotional level, and that I was the one who was experiencing the projective identification, her own warded off emotional needs. I experienced rage and anger towards her, as well as a preoccupation with her often fragmented emotional states. I felt she was too much to handle, that she needed too much of my care, that perhaps some of my other patients would suffer because I was too preoccupied with her, and that eventually I would become emotionally depleted and not want to see her anymore, which is a sort of emptied out breast feeling that you were discussing. I reflected on my own desire to reject her and get rid of her. At the same time, I feared she could have a breakdown as her affective states became more labile. So all of this sort of chaotic, infantile material was coming up, and I think her own sense of both rejecting and being rejected by mother needed to be experienced by me. I mean, I think it was very much both putting me in this very vulnerable position like the baby and feeling like, you know, nothing was really happening, nothing, there could be no sort of concern for me and who I was. At the same time, she needed to make me feel the sense of, you know, the mother not being able to really being depleted and emptied out and not being able to be there to give her the good nourishment. As the issues in the transference-countertransference relationship began to revolve more around the maternal infant dyad, the development of a sense of security, trust, and containment of Diana's rage and destructiveness became paramount. Memories of the early mother-infant relationship began to come to the fore with ever-increasing intensity. Her mother would not allow any of her bad feelings to exist in the relationship, and Diana felt profoundly rejected by her. She was made to feel guilty, strange, and wrong for feeling depressed. She did not think that her mother could understand her, and she consequently felt hopeless about our relationship. She felt at this point that her binging was something that she needed to hold on to, because it was the only thing that had been consistent for her during the past years and served a self-mothering function, as she could nurture herself by binging and give herself the illusion of being fed by a mothering figure. She described having the image in her mind of a breast that would nourish her. But she had strong ambivalent feelings towards this internal breast because it also aroused feelings of frustration, anger, and despair. It was really the first symbolic sort of experience that she began to have was this hallucinated breast that she so much desired but could not really provide her with nourishment. And I think this must have been related to some very early, perhaps even archetypal experience of the mother, because she never really felt she had that breast or could really symbolize it. You know, often in terms of Michael Fordham's work, the first symbol is of the breast, but in a sense the baby needs to have some experience of the breast and its absence before it can symbolize the breast, you see. And I think with her it was purely at the level of hallucination, really, and that she was desperately trying to reenact these she was trying to repair these experiences at such a deep level that she needed to create in her mind what would have happened in a more normal mother-infant relationship, that the breast would be presented when she needed it. And these strong ambivalent feelings, I think, had very much to do with her sense of despair and sense of not being nourished. Her difficulties with her mother began to preoccupy her more and more. She felt that her mother needed her to be perfect, and she would only reward her for her good looks, good performance, and good feelings. So it was this completely persona-oriented relationship, she felt. And she felt she went into an enormous fury towards her mother and the attacks upon her for all that had been denied her as an infant. And she became, this became a major, major focus, the rage, which was underneath the bulimia. Underneath all of this chaos, there was enormous rage. And it's interesting, at the same time she yearned for a close relationship to her mother and all that her mother represented. And as she could not turn successfully to her real maternal relationship, she turned to the inanimate world for a sense of security. She yearned to be close to the sea, to Mother Nature, and to recreate in a sensory manner the soothing and contained feeling of her early childhood when she spent her holidays near the ocean. And for her, it was the ocean that always provided this feeling. It was sort of the mother in the rhythm of the ocean, the rhythm of the waves. And the sport that she was involved in was a water sport. And I think that's why she was very much connected to that. She experienced a need for a connection to an archetypal earth mother, which was difficult to quell. It was as if she were attempting to hold herself together by adhering to sensory images and experiences of a long time ago, to an experience of an impersonal force of Mother Nature. At the archetypal level, the image of the all-giving Great Mother, what I would call Neumann's Good Mother, alternated with the image of the devouring and negating Great Mother figure, Neumann's Terrible Mother archetype. The archetypal image of the bliss-giving mother, with whom she wished to feel fused, was yearned for with intense desire. It was this archetypal image which her personal mother had not been able to mediate during infancy. It remained in her mind as a frustrating object of desire. So her mother never could really incarnate this sort of bliss-giving, breastfeeding mother image. Rather, the archetypal image of the castrating, devouring, withholding, and abandoning witch mother predominated. So she was very much dominated by these archetypal experiences at the core, when we got to this core material. And it was these, as I said, this withholding, abandoning witch mother was the image, the archetypal image, which was consolidated around her experience with her personal mother. In the transference, the desire to restore a feeling of lost union with the good aspects of the breastfeeding mother analyst, which was what she was trying to project into me, alternated with the fear of being caught in the clutches of a devouring, frustrating, and negating mother analyst. So here at the deepest level, these two archetypal images emerged with great clarity, and she kept alternating between the two of them, the desire to be cared for in this sort of blissful way, yet at the same time fearing being caught in the clutches of the kind of witch, the witch mother, negating mother. And I think over a great period of time, we tried to integrate this, and I think she began finally to be able to symbolize when the image of the archetype of the Great Mother came up in this dualistic manner. We were able to get to the core of some of what this problem, the bulimic problem, was all about. I want to really show you, and as we worked on this in great detail and sort of went through all of her memories of her infancy and what had happened, she finally went on to she finally discovered herself in through the sensation, through the sensorial realm, and she started to take some art courses, and she became very involved in textures and in painting textures and doing abstract art. And it was as if she was finally being able to construct some type of a containing skin type feeling. It was as if within the paint, the canvas itself in some way represented a skin function for her. She would go into these frenzied states and paint. And instead of being involved with the bulimia, she would be able to put all of her energy into creative endeavors, into the painting, which I supported. And she would spend hours and hours in the studio painting. But again, it was only after she was able to get to the archetypal core of the symptom that she was able to begin to transform some of the chaotic bodily experience into a creative form. And that seemed to be quite fundamental. And at the same time, I think she could only get to that by mediating the archetypal image in the transference. She needed me to go experience both sides of this dreadful mother archetype that she couldn't differentiate nor integrate, the good mother and the negative mother archetype.
And
she began then to, after she got to the archetypal core, she started to have memories of infancy. And there were some of them were quite scary because she had memories of being left in her crib. Nobody would come, nobody would see. The issue what came up were these sort of very depriving memories of being left in the crib. Nobody would come when she called. She would be crying. She didn't know where anybody was. It was sort of a lonely person left screaming. And the other aspect was of a lonely person falling into a dark hole. It was like there was nobody there to really hold her. when she was experiencing states of anxiety and panic, and they seemed, at least from the infant standpoint, to overwhelm her. And apparently what happened was that what we came to was that these were exactly the experiences which kept being recreated in the bulimic state, was that she had this fear of disintegrating and falling into nothingness, and the bulimia somehow kept her also rigidly and concretely attached to reality in a certain strange way because of the emphasis on the body and the bodily symptomatology. But at the core of it was this mother archetype problem in terms of how the mother wasn't able to mediate the archetype. And also at the core were these very frightening and anxiety-evoking infantile experiences. And with her as well, as you know, linking it to what I said last night, she came to experience the good aspects of the mother archetype in terms of her relationship to the sensorial world, to the sounds of the ocean, to the rhythm of the waves, and then slowly, not only fully to the textures of paint, and to her experience of the canvas and drawing and things of that nature. So one could see, in a sense, getting to the core and then seeing this slowly, this symbolic capacity and real transformation begin to evolve. I don't want to go too much into it. I mean, she became very preoccupied with different artists, especially Frida Kahlo, whose, you know, body image experiences were quite profound. She became very involved with Jackson. To her two sort of artists that she would focus on and her work was patterned after were, of course, Frida Kahlo, whose body was injured in that terrible accident and who painted her own body repetitively, and also Jackson Pollock, who was the artist who was involved so much in a kind of a ritualistic and almost altered state type of action painting. She did bring some. What I wanted to do, though, was to go into the art. The dream slowly evolved, and many of them at this point, they finally evolved, and they were about trying to gain some type of closeness to Mother. There were several lesbian dreams. There were several dreams of really trying to have this close, physical, and almost erotic relationship with Mother. And what I interpreted around those at the time was how much those seemed reparative for her, that she was finally able to have some symbolic representation, again, of an experience that she never had. You see, here we're dealing in an area not so much of, it's a reparative process in the sense that we have to, in analysis, almost create the experiences that were not lived. The experiences were never lived, her closeness with her mother, the sense of the availability of the breast, the nurturing situation. And the reason why this analysis was so torturous and so difficult was that she had to struggle with me intensely in order to go back with her and to recreate, not to recreate really, but to create experiences which she never had. And I think she was quite skillful of that. But this is why I think the analysis took so many years and had to be of such intensity for her. Okay, why don't I go through some of the pictures? And again, we stopped her analysis when she graduated from college. She graduated with honors. She won many awards for her artwork. It was quite remarkable. Her bulimia had abated quite a bit. It hadn't completely stopped, but I think she realized how much it was related to her internal anxiety states. She went back east for a period of time and wanted to go to art school. I think she really needed to separate from me, and I didn't want to thwart that either. So she went for a year back east, and then she returned to California, and I saw her sporadically for a period of time. I was very sort of tentative about taking her back into any type of intensive treatment. She had wanted to continue some treatment. And at this point, she finally decided that it would be a good idea to see a female therapist, which I really supported, in psychotherapy, not analysis, which she's doing, and she keeps in touch with me by letter and lets me know how things are going. And she's just completed graduate school in art and has been quite successful with that, having shows and things of that nature. So it was a case where I felt quite gratified, but I really had been through the ringer with her for many years. But I think she realized she's a person, she finally could realize what had happened after it all happened, you know, and she finally got it in terms of the symbolic issues. It was interesting that she bought her mother at one point a book, the book called The Man and His Symbols. She did not know I was a Jungian analyst. And she said, well, I'm very interested. My mother really needs to read this book because this is about what things, you know, this is what's going on. And I thought that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. So she was trying to sort of educate her mother in a certain way. I'm not sure how the mother took the book. But anyway, any questions about this material? Because it's very complex and hard to digest, I think.
You made a distinction just now. She re-entered psychotherapy.
Yes. Oh, because she didn't, I don't think she realized that she didn't need to go back anymore to that infantile period or to go into the intensive kind of relationship that she had with me. But what she really needed to do was to focus more exclusively on her more forward, you know, the more perspective looking side of her life in terms of what she was going to do and her work and more concrete things. Because the bulimia had been much more under her control, she felt, and it wasn't causing her the severe kind of distress. But I don't know what's going to happen with that therapy.
What was going on?
It's somewhat episodically. And she was struggling with her relationships with men. And I think that's why she wanted also to see a female therapist. I think she felt quite uncomfortable talking about her sexuality to me in terms of these other relationships. And I think probably with her relationship with her father, the issue of her feelings towards me and the other men and her, you know, needing to have some safe, protected space with another woman to talk to about that is something that I fully supported. So actually she went to the Institute, and this I said that would be a possibility. She had tried several clinics, and I said there was a clinic at the Jung Institute where she could be seen, and that's where she was seen by one of the interns who then took her into her private practice. At the Institute there's an intern program for people who are finished with their PhDs but aren't licensed to learn about Jungian psychotherapy. They don't do deeper analytic work, but they see the people once or twice a week. And she went to the clinic and saw one of the postdoctoral interns who took her into her practice.
I'd be interested in the criteria that distinguish analysis from psychotherapy.
Well, just that, you know, analysis deals often with uncovering the causes of problems, and from my standpoint, dealing very much in the transference-counter-transference relationship, understanding and allowing to evolve the earlier infantile and childhood aspects of the problem, and often involves people being seen, you know, more than twice a week. Now, that's not to say that some people in their analysis can go less frequently when they're more along their own path of development, when they've resolved some of these earlier issues. But I think analysis, you know, it's a very individual thing. I hesitate to use external criteria for analysis, but I think it's very much an internal issue about what the needs of a particular client are and what kind of work that they need to do on themselves in terms of where they need to go. And I have a faith that people usually, my own sense is that people always go to the areas where they need to work if they're given a proper type of situation and space for working on that. So, when I say psychotherapy, the interns are not yet trained as analysts. I mean, they're not in the analytic training program. And I believe, I'm not so involved with that program, but I believe that they usually see the people once a week. And they're not really supported to go very deeply because often they're only there for a year and some of the clients are not, you know, some of them don't go into private practice or whatever. So it's a more limited type of therapy rather than a full analysis. Anything else about her before we go into some of the slides? Okay. Let's see.
do that separately.
Excuse me, I'm not sure how this... Well, I need to put them in the right order, I think. Let's see. What the paintings meant. We spoke about them a bit. And she needed to actually keep these separate from her analysis for quite some time. She wanted them to be apart from it. And then later she brought them in and we discussed them. And I think this represents some of the fear, some of her sort of guardedness. The figure crouched in that way. It was one of her first representations, I think, of herself. She has a, looks like a artistic instrument in one of her hands. The color is very black behind the body. Kind of nondescript object, kind of barrier. This was one of the first ones, yes. I think she was quite talented. And she really, anyway, developed quite a bit. I think she was trying to divide some of the chaos inside of herself with these figures. And it gives you some sense, the internal chaos, the colors, the way the texture is, that she was really representing this bulimic state of mind and this difficulty containing things. You know, there's a kind of square in the middle, but it seems quite permeable, and there are certain objects, well, not really objects, but shapes on both sides, but there's so much intensity in the color inside of it. And again, she would describe being as she would be in a frenzied state of mind when she was doing this. She couldn't stop. There was something impelling her to express herself in this way. And everything else, in a sense, was tuned out around her. And she would throw herself completely into the activity of the painting itself. I think that's why she was so interested in Jackson Pollock.
Did she interpret these at all to you?
Somewhat. She said some she could and some she couldn't, because she was in this altered state when she did them. But she said they really represented all that we were talking about in the analysis, that after, you know, after a period she was able to go back to her studio and paint rather than engage in the binging, that the anxiety itself was put into the paintings.
That last slide, was that an early or late?
These are in sequential order. These are the order that she told me she had done them in.
Tremendous color sophistication.
Yes. Yes. There's a gradual differentiation of shapes and containers, which I think are important. She was trying to evolve some sense of a container. And I think the paint and the canvas served this function of trying to help her feel more coherent and more held together. And here there's, in a sense, a juxtaposition between the container on one side and a more phallic type object or shape on the right-hand side. And again, the energy, the colors, I think signify the kind of intensity of affect that she was experiencing at this time. If any of you have other associations, please feel free to comment on them. These were done often in a very pre-verbal state, unmeditated in a sense, hence her attraction to abstract expressionism. I mean, just this sort of emotional catharsis.
Well, I see a tremendous contrast to the previous slide.
Okay.
Again, showing this extremely painterly sophistication. The use of color is something that many professional painters don't achieve, and she's got it immediately. And this is. Appears to me to be on a much more elemental level. And I see on the right,
yes,
the phallic there is the sort of a wounded testicular kind of with sub-images inside,
yes,
which would be,
yes,
very interesting. So there might be the tortured father and the dangerous, with all the dangerous. And I would be very interested in hearing her talk about
the two elements inside.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so it's very intriguing.
I think also this was her secret that she couldn't really share with me completely, although she wanted to share the paintings with me, and she wanted to give me the slides when I told her that I would, you know, it would be helpful to discuss some of the material in an educational context. She was very interested in that and intrigued, and she gave permission to me to have, you know, to have the slides and then to use them for educational purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. A bit of a calmer feeling, not as tortured. Yes, yes. There is a great deal of intensity, I guess, right down. I'm not sure if I could. No, you can't do it that way. Down on the bottom of the, on the right hand side there. Yeah.
Was there much time between these?
I think she did these over, these were all done over a period of about a year and a half. And she would work on the paintings over a longer, over a, you know, a period of a couple of weeks, usually, each painting. She would work them and rework them and sort of try to see what was coming up.
You know, sometimes there are also intriguing little clues that come up in these things. For instance, I'm just having a fantasy.
Is that the right one?
Just at the left of the red area, there's a symbol that could be taken as a European seven or something like that. And sometimes these things can be clues to want to know, like, what happened at the age of seven or something.
Oh.
Things like that.
Well, because that's the order of things.
Sometimes you find out some amazing kind of thing.
Could you elaborate on that at all?
Well, for instance, sometimes people will draw a tree.
Yeah.
And there'll be eight pieces of fruit falling off the tree. And you find out that there was a horrendous trauma at eight. Another side of the tree, there's 13 pieces of fruit.
I see. So some quite literal.
So eight and 13, it turns out they were terrible experiences or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm just looking for things that might be
Were there seven or something?
Yeah, there was a see that element just to the left of the room.
Yes.
That could look like a European seven.
I see, and she was, as you said, seven when that was the major trauma when the parents divorced.
Well, it's good to look for that stuff without getting enamored of it.
Sure, but it's interesting to think about it in that way. Here again, she did tell me that she was very concerned with the borders and, the issue of the container and all that was happening inside. It was as if she was trying to find some sort of way of having all of this energy be held inside. And I think here you have another depiction of the internal life and the struggle with creating a boundary. You know, the bulimia, in a sense, was... There were no boundaries when she was bulimic. There was no sense of inside versus outside. She couldn't really keep things inside. And I think at this stage of her analysis, she was so concerned with the boundary issue that she was trying to have things held, in a sense, have things contained inside of herself. Any reactions to this painting? I think there was a lot of sexualization with the father, and he also appeared to be a man who had many affairs after the divorce with younger women, and I think she was always somewhat traumatized by that, and I think so the generational boundaries were somehow erased, and the father married a woman who was just not so many years older than she, the daughter, is, and also with the mother. The mother was also very much attracted to younger men and married someone who was about 20 years younger than she. So there was always a sense of competition for men, and the fathers wanting to have women that were like the daughter. And so it wasn't that she was explicitly sexually abused, it's that she never knew really where she was and where the generational boundaries could be drawn. No, no, the father was very intrusive, and I think that was the embarrassment and the shame on being given these lavish bouquets, you know, that would fill up her room. I mean, there were many of them at times. It was as if somebody had gotten a bouquet from a lover who was courting them in the most intense way. And here it was her birthday, but it was from her father. So I think it was too much. He couldn't control that with her. And I think that always was quite traumatic for her when these things arrived. And it was always with great sort of pomp and circumstance that people would arrive and start delivering all of these things. And she was just beside herself. She wanted to sort of run the other direction. You know? How so?
Well, the relationship, personal relationship.
Right. Yes, the father wanted her to live this sort of Hollywood lifestyle, be very preppy. You know, the father was quite wealthy and was very much into polo ponies and had all this sort of lifestyle like this. And he had given her the credit card, as I said, so she could entertain all of her friends at his expense. And of course, it was sort of her sweet revenge to run up all these bills and to say, yes, she had been to all these restaurants, but they were really for the purpose of her binging. So there was a great strain and struggle between father and daughter, I think, around this. Yes?
The thing that strikes me so much about this painting is this really intense container.
Yes.
Deep, dark, almost black. I mean,
it's blue. I believe it's sort of blue. Is it blue?
It's very dark.
Yes, yes. And she spoke about the perimeter quite a lot in the analysis.
And then in the center,
while she was doing this. Exactly. I think it's exactly a depiction of her state of mind. It was so much happening at a preverbal state that the words itself could never convey, and I could not convey in words what the experience was like, but I think this painting conveys much more what it was like. You know, the internal chaos and the search for this perimeter, this container, which we were both struggling with so much.
It just looks like bulimia.
How so? That's interesting.
I mean, just that sense of putting all of this stuff inside. But then there's the need to get it out.
Yes.
Although at this time that we were working with her, she may have reached some resolution.
Well, she was able to symbolize it.
Uh-huh.
And I think at least that was a step, you know, that she was able to utilize her creativity and her creative function to symbolize it meant that she could begin to think about it. Before, they were, in a sense, unthinkable thoughts. And because the bulimia was such a somatic symptom, she couldn't really think about it in order to integrate and metabolize these thoughts. So the painting was really quite a step for her.
You know, I have a sort of fanciful thing. I was thinking just before you said that it looked bulimic, I was thinking to myself that I could see this as the representation of the stomach, where this tortured, bloody kind of coagulation of all these things. But the hopeful part is that there's a lot of white in there, and could symbolize that through the analysis, now some light was being brought into this turmoil.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, it's easy to say that after you know the story.
Well, it's fine. Sure, we can switch. Now again, look at the border and look at the internal, the sort of almost fetal shape, I think, and the stomach area.
Tortoise-like.
Yes, it's rather amphibious. That's why I felt fetal. Yeah. But it. Yes. Yes. She was trying to be reborn, I think. And I think this was her attempt, at least one symbolic explanation, of her attempt to enter back into the womb so she could start this process all over again, because the first time around it had been such a catastrophe. So I think that she had wanted to, you know, it's a representation of sort of being back in the womb, perhaps in some way, in this aquatic area.
You know, it's interesting too,
Yes. Yes. Yes, I thought it was mostly happening in me. It was that kind of infantile experience, you know, where the baby has to be held by the mother and the mother has to begin to try to intuit what the baby's needs are. And I think that's what happened with her, in a sense, in a different way, is that with the mother couldn't really translate the baby's physiological responses into emotional responses. In other words, that the baby's crying, so that often the mother, who's not able to be attentive, says, well, the baby must be hungry, because if you feed the baby, then the baby stops crying. And I often have found that also with eating disordered patients, that there's this kind of miscuing between mother and infant, that the mother, in a sense, misrepresents the internal state to the baby, and so the baby becomes quite confused. And later, as adults, some of these clients talk about when they feel anxious, well, they need to eat. And when you go back, when these memories begin to come up, it's that the mother or the mothering figure used the bottle or the nipple as a way for the child to be calmed and soothed, rather than holding or trying to make sense of with the child and struggling with the child. And I think something like that also must have happened here, some kind of misrecognition of her internal states. Mm-hmm. Yes, no, I mean, I think that was the major purpose of the therapy, was to provide some container for hers.
It seems like, once again, that there's a lot of very interesting unconscious material possibly expressed in the border.
Yes.
The theme of four and the X's are constantly repeated.
Mm-hmm.
And on the top and the bottom and on the side, we keep seeing four, units of four.
Mm.
And the two, kind of, if it would be a turtle, the left hand upper limb, sort of red figure, this line going up on the diagonal sort of the top corner, and that's sort of pointing to the two triangle shapes. And on the opposite side, on the left, there's another red line or a tail light structure which is pointing up to what could be a pointy, more masculine form. It's interesting, the two opposite corners up there. You have the feminine triangle on the right and the piercing masculine on the left.
Yes,
and that's
yes,
possible.
Yes.
Unconscious.
Well, it's an interesting statement.
The triangle is also
that's
what it is.
Yeah. Oh,
you
did.
Yeah. We can go on, yes, sure. And here again, there's this theme of inside and outside, and the red figure on the side, sort of in a transitional space. It seems a bit calmer, at least the internal part.
The border is much stronger.
Yes, the border is thicker and stronger. Yes. And there are shapes within shapes, and she's more focused on that, it seems. There's more sort of a shapeliness to it.
Is her outside light still, you know, somewhat maybe chaotic? Or
it was getting much more organized. Because she, when she found her sort of her vocation, she began to be able to focus much more of her activity around her art. And I think that sort of provided her, her creativity in and of itself provided her with a center, a core identity.
It's almost like there's an inner light, you know, that, I don't know, but I just get the sense of an inner
light.
Yeah.
Well, the light of her own consciousness, I think, was her own expanding consciousness is probably what's involved in that. There's a kind of brightness emanating from within. I think, Lucretia, was what you're referring to. I would agree with that. Again, in her analysis, she talked mostly about the borders and her struggle with the borders, with the enclosing areas.
Maybe having to close out the outside in some ways to stay in touch with
it. Yes, Yes. And I didn't want to tamper too much with what was inside, because again, I thought that was her need for privacy. In some area, of, you know, she always had, I felt she had a need for this kind of integrity of her own self, and something that needed to remain, in a sense, to me, mysterious. And so I never really probed her so much, even when I looked at this. I asked her what they meant to her, but I didn't really want to probe or penetrate too much of the deeper meaning of the interior space.
So her chosen vocation was art?
Art. She became an artist. She's changed now. I mean, she's been doing a lot. She does a lot of painting, but she was doing also a good deal of sculpture. And then she went more into some video production and performance types of things. Sort of she expanded herself. This is what the period where I was seeing her in, during the initial phase, you know, during the period that I discussed in the paper, before she went to graduate school. This is when she was an undergraduate art major.
You want the next one?
Yes, please. Here's some sort of, well, there seems to be a body. And here the interior space is much blacker and darker.
But it,
I'm sorry? They're actually quite large, because she had an exhibit of them at the university, which I went to see with her permission. And they were large canvases. She would work with them while she was on the floor. She didn't work with them in an easel format. She wanted to be sort of down there and right in it.
Hands and knees.
Hands and knees and fingers and hands and literally. You know, she really needed to be very, again, the sensorial aspect was very important to get some sense of that texture and the feeling of the paint against the canvas. It was like that's how she was defined. She was beginning to define herself in this deeply bodily way. At times she did, as she used different types of objects to paint with. Any comments on this particular picture? Or? Yeah.
It's almost like a sword there on that bottom.
Yeah. Also, the top, there's something penetrating in a bit of an ominous way. One wonders about the penis or the phallus, the issue of this dreadful penetration. Again, she did not mention that to me, but there was always this fear in terms of her sexuality of being penetrated by something that would be perceived as being bad and threatening.
And it's red.
And it's red, yeah.
Was there anything about the age of four that was a particular trauma?
I don't know, really. I'm not sure. Why do you say the four?
Well,
again,
there were so many fours initially, and
yes,
there, at the very end of the red form where it enters,
yes,
blue,
there's
four.
Sure, sure. I think it was just as she was entering her Oedipal period. I think it was with the father. I think it was so terribly difficult.
I also see here what seems to me an influence from the artistic world,
yes,
from the ancient world, where here she seems to be freer to allow in, let's say, Egyptian and Etruscan kind of elements that she may have seen, and even Native American, the color schemes and the painting,
yeah,
shows yet more freedom,
uh-huh,
to experiment in the realm of paint.
Yeah.
It's much more,
okay,
painterly in some ways, and very free, even though I hadn't even thought of that red element as necessarily being so dangerous, although I see,
yeah,
it now, but more a kind of an insect, kind of a primitive insect representation in a sense, the feeling, and,
yeah,
and the yellow element being very Egyptian or something,
okay,
like that, and seemed like, in some ways, very positive.
This one she did tell me a bit about, as I remember, it was somehow a representation of the mystery, she said. And it had a sacred feeling to her. It was looking for this ritual which could contain her own internal feelings. And it was very much looking for the mystery.
You said she'd come to experience both the good and the terrible moment. And there's that great,
yes, moment. That's quite possible, yes. That was seemed to be the core of the emotional conflict, was this need to integrate these two polarities of the mother archetype.
Mm-hmm.
at the deepest level, this is what came out.
Yeah, because you could say that inside the yellow element, there is like a black sun.
Uh-huh.
On the right, so there's an inversion.
Yes,
which
is
something that the Egyptians, you know, would have related to very easily.
Okay.
So that's, you know, it fits in with her mystery explorations very nicely. That's interesting.
Calcinatio?
The yellow is what?
Is it?
Calcinatio. And the Veda is bringing in with life force.
Yeah, perhaps it's illuminating the darkness in there is another way to describe it. Yes. 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 It was interesting experiencing that maternal archetype was the point of transformation for her when it sort of all began to open up. Okay. And here again is the representation of the secret, as she called it. The secret contained in the internal part. And you can see again, can that be focused a little bit? It looks like from my eyes, I don't know. Yeah, that's very nice. Yes, the poisonous. Yes, the dreadful worms. Do you mean in the interior space of the object or on the outside, the red? Which ones? Were you feeling with
the
worm like?
The back 5 or 6 slides too.
Yes.
Where somebody says it's not the content, so you get that feeling of the worm.
But worms, snakes, I mean, it's this representation of intense energy. And I think even in her childhood, what kind of worms would cause this tremendous appetite? It's this enormous energy.
A tapeworm.
Yes. But I mean, in her childhood conception, she had this sense of these things inside of her. And it was like this tremendous energy that she didn't know.
I wonder if her parents had too much energy to contain itself, and she was always, you know, fidgeting at the table.
Yes,
can't you just control yourself? Don't do that in the house. Be quiet.
Well, her mother would redirect her. She would say, well, why don't you redecorate the house? Or why don't you clean, do this or that?
So she did have a lot.
She had a lot of energy, but the mother sort of used it for her own purposes.
Sure.
I'm at work all day, and so you have all this energy. You can make clean, you can fix up the house. You can do creative things there. You can make dinner. You can take care of the kids. And while you're at it, that type of thing. So there was a certain exploitation. Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of movement and creativity in this. And here things become, it appears a bit more organized internally in the space in the center. Again, surrounded by the blue kind of water with a very aquatic feeling.
Yeah. It's so powerful.
Yes. This was one she spoke a great deal about in terms, it gave her some sense of completion, this one.
Yeah, it's very interesting to contrast this one with the previous one. The previous one was very painterly.
Yes.
And this one is not. I mean, this is right out of the self.
She felt very satisfied with this.
It almost seems to me a human form emerging.
Yeah. It's like, you mean like a birth or a...
I haven't seen anything that looked like a form.
Yes,
in terms of
I
a
see.
Person,
yeah, humanoid.
Somehow there's kind of amorphous form.
Yeah, biomorphic. Mm-hmm.
What did she say about the poem?
She said that she felt quite satisfied with it. It made her feel quite calm, mm-hmm. and that it represented a resolution of some of her internal states mm-hmm. in terms of the chaos. And it was around the forms on the outside, she felt more satisfied with that. And also yeah. that there's several borders within borders. Yeah. And I think she felt much more sort of held together mm-hmm. and contained in that process.
And there, if you would imagine that figure you spoke of, is seated on top of the gold.
Yes, uh-huh. the gold there. Yeah. This too she liked. It had more balance in it, she felt. And again, there's several borders. It's like she's feeling much more contained. And so there's an increase in the number and the feeling of the those boundaries, you know, the contained space.
Also a depth.
Okay.
The center moves.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. It's almost like a crystal.
Yeah.
Yes. There's that gold in the middle. Yeah. And there is a calmer feeling around the border there. It's not so sort of tense. Yeah. You know, it has a softer feeling to it.
The center is taking more foreground.
Yes. Okay, well, let's. Well, I see we're going to have to stop in a couple of minutes, so any other questions that you might have or comments before we stop or feedback? I'd be happy, it's always helpful to get feedback how you felt about this, if some of your sort of questions were addressed or not.
Well, I personally, I think there was a tremendous balance. I like the mixture of discussion and lecture and the pictures and poetry that you brought on. To me, it's been very fulfilling. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
I think you're hearing about the way you don't turn now about, especially the way you give it an evening.
Thank you.
Because
sure, I can give them to you.
There's so much that is behavioral.
Yes.
It would really be helpful.
Sure, sure. Okay.
What I would be interested too is in any references in terms of reading material on post-cultural issues, sexuality and body.
On sexuality and body in adolescence. You know, there's not a lot written, unfortunately, at this point. We're putting together a book, the group of analysts, of developmental analysts, Santa Fe, who've been working in Santa Fe a lot on this area. The only other work, really, has been done by some of the more classical Freudian analysts, and they take a very classical Freudian position, not as symbolic as we would. So really, it's a very new, emerging field, working analytically with adolescents in this way. So there's not a lot yet written about it. Although there's some, of course, you know, there's the original work by Erik Erikson. These are the analysts who have written mostly in this area, by Peter Bloss, who talks a lot about the issue of the father. He's also a classical Freudian analyst. There are two books by a group of the Laufer. They're called Laufer and Laufer, who are two Freudian analysts in London. And that's about it, really, in terms of people who have specialized in analytic work with adolescents. It's really a very meager area, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Brian, for being
thank
here
you.
Today. And I think
Thank you all. Thank you very much.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Ewing Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.